Okay, well, we're just coming up on 7:30 now, so I am going to go ahead right now, and I'm going to mute all. But as I just mentioned, unusual for our monthly meetings, I'm going to allow everybody to unmute themselves. In particular, this will be important for the EGM portion of the meeting, where people may want to make some comments and so forth. So I'm going to stop the share and find the deck for EGM. There we go there. And I find my Zoom controls now. Where are they? Okay, there we go. There we go. So welcome all to the February 2025 meeting of the Ottawa PC User Group. As is the normal course of events on our February meeting, we kick it off with the annual general meeting and then follow that with our regular presentation. So with that, I will get into the AGM. So on the agenda for the AGM, we will talk about the election results, then we will have information about the board reports, and then follow that with questions or comments. So there were only 8 nominations received by the deadline of December 31st. So the following are acclaimed in order by name. First name, Alan German, Bob Harris, Bob Walker, Bridget Lord, Chris Taylor, Gail Egan, Jocelyn Edouard, and Karen Wallace-Greiner. So thank you all to those who were nominated. We will be looking for a ninth board members, so if you are interested in joining the board of directors, by all means talk to anybody who is on the current board, and we can take it from there. So in addition to the board members, I would like to thank, or the board would like to thank, Linda Buskey, who was the election chair and has also stepped forward to become the membership chair. Mark Carrier, who was the membership chair for many, many years and has stepped down from that role. Richard Aylesworth, who has been for many years our financial reviewer. And Wayne Houston, who was privacy chair, who has stepped down from that position. So as I mentioned, we are going to be looking to appoint a ninth member of the board. So for the board reports, the president's report was in the February newsletter. And the treasurer's report was in the February newsletter, and Alan is going to, if I give him the control, slide control, Alan. Okay, Alan, you now have you have slide control, so take it away.
Okay, so this is the report for the last calendar year, which is our fiscal year, 2024. And if the slides will advance, which they're not going to, can't get the slides to advance, Chris.
You've got the control?
Yeah, but I'm pressing the page down or the, oh, wait a minute, maybe I have to select the, no, I.
Try clicking on the arrows that are in the slide control.
Not doing anything for me. So can you advance the slide, please?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so the good news is we're still well in the black in terms of assets. We've got just under $14,000 in the bank and in one-year GICs, essentially, staggered one-year GICs. Next slide, please. And this is the income and expense statement. You can see basically there are two big items for income, almost $500 in bank interest, which reflects the high GIC interest rates right now, or at least what they have been over the last year. And we also had quite a bit of membership income, $480 in memberships. Even though we gave current members a free pass on renewal, so those must all be mostly, anyway, will be new memberships. And those are largely coming from library presentations, people seeing Chris and Linda basically doing their stuff at the library and then deciding that membership is a good idea. So we took in almost $1,000, but we spent about $2,000. And again, typically that's because the big items there are almost $900 in meeting expenses. So that's things like a Zoom account for these online meetings. And also the fact that we give external speakers and non-board members who give presentations $100 honorarium. The second big item there is $628 for the, it says barbecue expense, but these days it's our pizza party. And so those are the two big items. So we spent overall about $2,000. And so the bottom line is that we exceeded, our expenses exceeded income by about $1,000, $1,097 and change. But that's predicted. The board is well aware that we're spending more than we're taking in. And that's because we have a policy for quite a number of years now to try and drive down our assets while providing benefits to members. Next slide, please, Chris. And so this is showing you what happened in the last 5 years. And you can see the green is income, the red is expenses, and they go up and down depending what we do over the year. The yellow is basically the money in the bank, the total assets that the computer club owns, and that is declining. And again, that's because we took a specific decision that we don't need $18,000 in the bank, and we will try and drive that down over a number of years. And the main way we're doing that is to waive membership renewal fees. So when you become a member, we don't ask anybody to pay a renewal fee. And because we're not collecting renewal fees, then we're basically spending more than we're taking in every year. But you can probably imagine that if we're in the hole for $1,000 every year and we've got $14,000 in the bank, we've got quite a few years before we have to do any worrying. So the board will keep an eye on the finances, but it's for the moment it's steady as she goes. And that's it for me. Next one says, any questions?
Yes, so feel free to unmute yourself if you want to ask a question, make a comment, or you can type it into the chat and we'll relay it through. So we'll give a bit of a pause here.
I would just like to thank Alan for making a remarkable job as a treasurer for the last 20 years, something like that. So I think you deserve a nice applause from everybody for that.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, I've been treasurer for 20 years, but I've decided it's time to hand over the reins to somebody younger and keener. So.
But Alan's not going away.
Well, I'm not going away, right?
Okay, thanks, Alan. I'll just jump back here. Yeah, the secretary's report will be in the March newsletter, so that'll be upcoming. Okay, and that's it, actually. So I want to express thanks to the 2024 board members, the assistants of the board, so the membership chairs, Mark Caillet in the first part of the year, and Linda Buskey since, I guess, about August, the financial reviewer, Richard Aylesworth, and the election chair, Linda. I'd like to thank our presenters. So we had four presenters from outside of the user group, Adam Hunt, Brett Martinson, Mark Schulman, and Sebastian LeMay. And we had five presentations from OPCEG members. So thanks very much to Alan, Bob, Carol, Linda, and Tom. I'd like to thank the – sorry?
Sorry.
You're muted again, Tom.
I'll wait your thanks, Earl.
Oh, okay. Newsletter contributors. So those people who have written articles for the newsletter and kept that full, so that's really great. The weekly Q&A sessions, which have been wildly successful for the last 5 years. So our co-chairs, myself and Alan, as well as the members who either gave contributions during Q&A through shares of interesting things they come across or asking and answering questions and contributing to the conversation. And those members who attended, because without the people showing up, it would have been a really quiet Q&A session. And I'd like to thank all the members for being part of it all. So now I'd like to throw it open for anybody for questions, comments. Tom.
One question from our membership cares. How many members have we gained and lost? And also, what are the demographics of our membership? Do we all have white or no hair?
I don't know that we track the hair, hair
ask,
situation.
We don't ask age on the membership form, but I do track it. And right now, currently, in terms of current members, we just hit 200. Well, 201 actually this week, but we hit the 200 mark, so that was great. But I have done, as you saw a couple of months ago, I did do a bit of time tracking historical trends and that. And I can do some more of that if that's of interest to the group. I can do it more regularly. But no, you'd have to just sort of look around the pictures, I guess, Tom.
I do think that having periodic updates on trends or interesting factoids that come out of our membership would be of interest. So if you're willing to do those deep dives, Linda, I think everybody would appreciate it.
Sure.
How about the furthest away?
I could do that, but I looked at it a little bit. There weren't enough to really. But yeah, I could put it in a map or something just for fun.
I think you do know the furthest away.
I do know the furthest away.
Yeah, we have a BC member.
My uncle. So
we have some international members now as well. We have at least one current member in the United States.
Yeah.
So.
Of course, there's a tariff on that person. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, any other questions or comments? I see from Bill, we really appreciate all you've done for the OPCUG over the last 20 years, as well as all the time spent in talks and preparation for them. So I guess that 20 years, that's referring to you, Alan, so very well done.
Oh, and thank you to the people volunteering to do one-on-ones, too.
Oh, yes, I should have actually put them on the slide as well. My error on that. Thank you for reminding us on that, Carol. Yes, our one-on-one remote assistance program has 6 volunteers who every time there is a request come in for remote assistance, it goes out to that group of volunteers, and they can discuss the issue the person is having, decide on who would be the most appropriate person to be able to help them out, and let that person run with it. So, yes, thank you very much. And anybody else who wants to be part of that team of volunteers, just let us know. Okay, I don't see any other comments in the chat, and I don't see anybody else unmuting themselves to make a comment. So I think with that, I will call the annual general meeting to a close. I'll stop that share, and we will move on to the next main presentation. Let me just get this set up. Okay, now. There we go. So, tonight's presentation is How to Buy a PC. I've given this presentation quite a few times at the Ottawa Public Library, and Alan and I gave a tag team effort on this a couple of years ago, and we thought that this was actually something that would be appropriate given the end of life for Windows 10 coming up this fall, that maybe there are going to be some people that are wondering what to do now that their older computer running Windows 10 is no longer going to be supported. And certainly from a standpoint of security, I do not recommend that people run an operating system that is not supported by the vendor from a security point of view. So one of the options certainly is to replace it with a brand new PC. So, the question does come along, what is the, you know, the best choice is going to be for a new PC. And I'll start off by saying that I'm not going to tell you, you know, buy Lenovo or avoid Acer, or, oh, you have to have a PC that has 32 gigs of RAM or anything like that. The type of PC that is going to be right for you is almost certainly going to be different than the PC that would be right for me. And that's fine. What I'm going to hopefully do is arm you with the information about the choices that you have to make when buying a new PC and give you some of the background so that you can make the choices that are right for you so that you don't overspend and you don't underspend to the point where you end up with a PC that is not going to meet the needs of your computing. As we go through, I left it so that everybody can unmute themselves. So by all means, jump in. If you, you know, have a question about something I'm presenting on, I think we have a fair amount of time to be able to cover questions and so forth as we go through. If you have a difference of opinion from me, I welcome that as well. So we're going to look at broadly the laptop versus desktop, because that is one of the arguments that you're going to have to make up right at the front of it all. But then we'll dive into the components. So we'll be spending most of the evening talking about the different components that make up the PC. We'll talk about some special form factor computers and why you might want to consider them or avoid them, depending on your needs. I always like to throw in something about backup, so we'll have a slide on backup and why that's important and where you can go for more information when talking about that. And we'll talk about narrowing down your decisions. Once you've decided those things of saying, okay, this is the type of thing I need, you might end up still with hundreds of choices out there in the marketplace. So how do you narrow that down? So we'll start off with the broad brush of the laptop versus desktop. So a laptop, some of the advantages of it, portable and compact is really a big thing. I give a lot of library presentations. I would not give library presentations if I had to unplug my desktop computer and haul it out to a library branch. As it is, it's very easy for me to grab my laptop and move around, not only when I'm going outside of the house, but when I'm computing around in the house. If it's a nice sunny day in the summer, I might want to go out on the back deck and continue computing. And having a portable or a laptop really makes that easy for me to do. If you care about the greening or the cost of electricity, they do have lower power consumption on a laptop, and that's because they have to be able to operate on battery, and so they tend to really sip when it comes to power consumption. And you can really tune them so that you can tune down the performance of the computer to give yourself better battery life as well. They are a complete solution. So when you walk out of the store with that one little tiny box, you get a monitor, keyboard, trackpad, which is the equivalent of a mouse. You'll get speakers, webcam, and microphone, all built into the system itself. So you've got a complete computing solution right there. One of the things that I really like is Windows Hello for authentication, and you'll get that on mid to high end, and it'll be either fingerprint or facial recognition using Windows Hello capable camera or fingerprint reader. And I find that really, really handy. Once you actually experience that, I think most people, it's a checkbox item that they must have going forward. A lot easier than typing in passwords or working with other forms of authentication. On the disadvantages side of things, they are more expensive, or you could say they're less powerful for the same dollar value. That gap is becoming narrower. It used to be a significant difference in the price, but nowadays it's almost, you know, for the same powerful computer, it's almost the same price. But I think it's still a little bit more expensive on the laptop side. You do have a small screen, and that can be a really big detriment to some people. Now you can plug in external monitors to get yourself extra screen real estate, not so portable. So, you know, that can be an issue for some people. I find the keyboards on most laptops are very cramped. You very rarely will get a separate numeric keypad. The layout of the arrow keys can be these bizarre little keys that are hard to hit and things like that. I really do not like cramped keyboards that you find on laptop computers for the most part. They're less expandable, because you don't have that big empty space that a desktop computer will have. And if you can expand it, which you can sometimes do it on both storage as well as memory, it typically will be more expensive to expand it on a laptop. And that's because you're ending up with a cramped little space in there. So the components are, they have to be more heat tolerant and things like that. So it tends to be a little bit more expensive to do the expansion.
A couple of other advantages, Chris, that people are mentioning here, that your laptop's protected because it has a battery in the case of a power failure. Also, you can keep working on it when there's a power outage.
True. Yeah, that's a big one for sure. Now, it can be a little bit limited because your router is probably not battery powered, or unless you have a UPS or something like that, so you're going to be not on the internet anymore. But yeah, you keep on working. And I guess even more important that to me is that it doesn't crash. So if you have your computer crashing, that's a rather impolite way to shut down the computer. And bad things can happen when you have a crash all of a sudden. So having it that it continues on and you can do a polite shutdown on it, definitely an advantage. I see Tom says 17-inch laptops usually have a numeric keypad, useful for accounting, useful for a lot of things. So, yeah, I gave up personally on 17-inch laptops. I tend to go to more compact ones, but, yeah, that's could be an advantage for there. Limited USB ports. We'll talk more about USB ports going on. Thunderbolt USB ports, USB 4 ports, good for adding storage. Yeah, we'll be talking a little bit more about ports later. A laptop disadvantage. Some laptops are harder to install or update components. Yeah, it's, you know, taking them apart is not for the faint of heart in order to be able to do any servicing on it. So on the desktop side, the advantages, basically we're flipping the advantages and disadvantages. So they are less expensive or more powerful for the same dollar value. Much easier and less expensive to expand. You see that graphic of the system unit. Most of that is empty space. And so there's lots of room for extra drives, potentially many more memory slots that are available for you, CD writers, DVD writers, things like that. A lot of room inside there for expansion. And because it's not cramped space, they don't have to worry about heat buildup as much. They tend to be less expensive components that you're putting in there for equivalent components. You do get bigger keyboard and monitor. How much bigger is dependent on you, how much you want to spend on it, and certainly easier to fix. If I have a problem with my laptop computer, it's almost certainly going to be going back to the manufacturer. Even if I bought it at a computer store here, it's highly likely that if I bring it back to them under warranty, that they're going to end up shipping it back to the manufacturer to have the repair done. A desktop computer, heck, even I'll try some of the repairs of some of the things in it. You know, swapping out a hard drive, very, very easy, adding memory modules, adding a video card, things like that. Quite simple to do. And even if you don't feel like doing it, a local computer store is much more likely to be able to do those repairs on site. So you get your computer back in days or a week rather than 6 weeks while it goes back to the manufacturer. And I see usually laptops can upgrade SSDs, RAM, Wi-Fi, but nothing else. Yeah, exactly. Externally, you can add SSDs, expensive GPUs. Yeah, I haven't looked into external GPUs. I've heard of them, but I have no experience with them. On the desktop, the disadvantage aside, not portable. So again, when I buy a desktop computer, the one I'm looking at right now, it went into that place the day I bought it, and it has not moved since. And it will not move from there until such time as I get rid of it and move up to something else. They are bigger and heavier, so if you have space constraints, that could be an issue for you. Higher power consumption for sure. And there's more to add to it to get to a usable computer. So keyboard and mouse are usually included with desktop computers. But you don't get a monitor, speakers, microphone, webcam. All of those things are things that you have to add on. Now, partial offset to that is that as you upgrade computers, you don't necessarily have to upgrade monitor, speaker, webcam, microphone, things like that. Those may suffice through 3 or 4 generations of computers before you decide that you want a different monitor, speakers, or whatever. And I see Jocelyn says, keyboard of laptop is often very annoying for those who want to type French. The keys for the accents keep changing places from brand to brand. Yeah, I highly recommend that you... Well, Yeah, it can be really an issue. It can be an issue on desktop keyboards as well, but language setups are definitely an issue. Desktops are noisier than laptops. Not necessarily. I've seen some laptops that can be pretty noisy as well.
The fix for that, though, Chris, is to use a wireless keyboard because that has
true.
A standard setup, and it also will have a numeric keypad.
Yeah, but then that takes away a little bit from your portability, you know, things like that. So there's all of these things are trade-offs for sure. Tom wants to use key stickers to remap the keyboard. Yeah. Okay. Now let's start looking into the components that make up the computer. So these are the components that we're going to go through tonight, starting with the processor, the brains of the computer, memory, storage, where you store your operating system and programs and data when the computer is turned off, video cards, the way that the computer gets information from the computer onto the screen. We'll look at webcams, surprising number of slides I have on webcams, I'm not sure why. We'll talk about optical drives, DVD and CD writers. We'll talk about ports that you can find on computers and how they differ. Card readers, we'll talk a little bit about networking and very small amount about printers. So the CPU, central processing unit, AMD decided to muddy the waters a number of years back by calling them APUs for advanced processing units, but basically they're the brains of the computer. There are a number of factors that come into the performance. First is just raw speed, and faster is better. So these are usually measured in gigahertz, and it's cycles per second. So it's the operations that can happen over a set period of time. If you double the speed of the processor, you are not going to get a computer that is twice as fast. There are many, many more components that go into the overall experience of how fast a computer feels to you or gets things done. But speed is important on the CPU. I would hazard a guess that if you double the speed of the processor, you might get an overall, and you keep everything else the same, you might get an extra 15-20% performance out of the computer, something like that. The other way you can get better performance is increasing the number of cores. I'll step back a little bit here and say that when the PCs first came out, there was a way of actually increasing performance of CPUs, and it was by going to a multi-processor motherboard. And you had complete processor, and you had a socket for an extra one, and you could drop it in. And you would end up that the operating system would see the processors, figure out how to actually use them, and you would get better performance. It was a relatively expensive way of getting additional performance on a PC. As such, it was usually only used in data centers or, you know, very, very high-end CAD-CAM processing and things like that. Along came Intel, and they figured out that they could put multiple cores on a single die. Now, a core has most of the processing capability of a complete processor, but then there are some components that are shared amongst all of the cores that are on that one die. Things like memory access, power management, and things like that would be shared amongst all the cores. But most of the capabilities of a complete CPU are on each of the individual cores. So more is better because the operating system can hand off tasks to a different core that isn't busy. And so more is better. Doubling the number of cores is not going to double the speed of your computer. I think that more important, I think, than just the raw capability of going to get more done in the same period of time is that multiple cores can smooth out the experience. You will not end up so much with bottlenecking where one program is hogging the capabilities of the whole computer and you can't get other things done at the same time. So with multi-core, you can have different processes are handed out to different cores, and therefore you will end up with a much nicer performance. Now that really makes the difference going from single core to two cores. After that, it becomes a diminishing return on how many cores will actually help you in that regard, and there are very, very few single core processors out there anymore. But keep it in mind that one of the benefits is smoothing out the performance on the computer. Then you have different families from one manufacturer can have different performance characteristics, and then newer generations within a family will generally perform better and they'll have more capabilities, more features available to the operating system and how it can get work done. So here's where we start talking about the different processor families. So I'll stop, pause here a little bit and say that from here through the next about five or six slides, there's going to be a lot of information that is relevant when I first wrote these and is becoming less relevant as time goes on. But currently, it's still important. I'll point out when we get to the idea that all of a sudden things are changing. So with Intel, the core processors, Core i3, Core i5, Core i7, Core i9, those are the mainstream to high-end processors that Intel had around. The higher number generally means better performance, additional features, and I think that for most people, i5 and i7 would be the best options. i3 on the budget side of things, if you're trying to save money, you could go down to Core i3, but you do take a performance hit going down from the Core i5 to the Core i3. Going up to the Core i9, I think mostly it's gamers that are going to see advantages to going to Core i9. I think most people, Core i5 and Core i7 are the sweet spot, and quite frankly, I'm starting to think that there's not that much benefit going from a Core i5 to a Core i7. There is some, but it's minor. On the budget line, you have Pentium and Celeron, and they're still around. They are lower performance than the core processors, and if you're really, really trying to come in with a budget PC, you might want to consider them, but if you're not trying to save every last nickel, I would tend to avoid Pentium and Celeron. And if money is no object, or you're using a workstation-type task or data center-type stuff, Xeon is Intel's high-end, and most people, you're not going to be looking at Xeon. And you'll see the URL at the bottom there. I mean, you can go in and you can get a lot of information from Intel about their individual processors. So here we're getting into the things that this is going to go away before very long. Decoding Intel Core. And every time you buy a computer, it will actually list out that processor number like that. Intel Core i7 1065 G7. It'll be listed like that. How do you decode that? Well, the brand is the Intel Core. The brand modifier is the i7, so that's the level within that family. The first two digits are the generation indicator, so this is a 10th gen, and then it's a stock keeping unit beyond that, the 6.5. And you can actually look up that what that 6.5 actually means for any particular processor if you really care. And then there's a product suffix on it, which will do things like tell you about graphics, whether it's built in or not, whether it's, if it's a K, it's unlocked, gamers love that. So there's all kinds of things that can come into what those processor numbers actually mean. You can decode the Pentium and Celeron as well, and I didn't have the chart for it, but you can go to their Intel's website and you can find out how to decode all of the full specs of the processors. Now we get into how it's becoming a little bit more difficult, and the latest from Intel is Core Ultra. So it was launched first for mobile, and it will, I'm not sure if they even have Core Ultra yet for desktop, definitely is following on from the mobile. And it includes what is known as an NPU, a neural processing unit, which is all about artificial intelligence. I'll have a little bit more to talk about artificial intelligence later on. They are very power efficient. So, again, because they launched for mobile first, power efficiency is really, really important in mobile. They have built-in Arc graphics, and that is getting some really good press in terms of its capabilities for gaming and CAD-CAM, video editing, things like that. Now, the next version of Windows, which is probably going to come out in the fall, it's highly likely to take advantage of an NPU. Right now, Microsoft is releasing features in Windows 11 that are aimed at an NPU, or neural processing unit. They are few and far between. So some of the advantages the advanced features that are going to be built into Windows are only going to be available if you have an NPU. It's not to say that Windows won't run. You know, the next version won't run on a Core i7 or something like that, but just realize that some advanced features are not going to be available unless you have an NPU, and I'll talk more about where you're going to get those in the future. The AMD families, so they have the Ryzen, which is sort of like the core level of computing in the Intel world. So we have Ryzen 3, 5, 7, 9, and Threadripper. And that's the mainstream to high-end, so just like the Intel Core. On the budget side, they have Athlon, and it competes with Intel Pentium and Celeron. And they have EPYC, which is on the high-end servers and workstation, and pretty much competes with the Intel Xeon processors. So you can decode AMD Ryzen, for now, in a similar manner. So, again, they have a segment, whether it's for enthusiasts, high performance, mainstream, things like that. And they have suffixes which tell you if it's, you know, low power, standard mobile, all those sort of things. So you can look up all of those numbers for now. This is something that I found really, really interesting. Linus Sebastian from Linus Tech Tips put out a video, and he talked about how both AMD and Intel are messing around with those product codes so that they are what we knew before is totally meaningless moving forwards. And they both seem to be feeling free to just monkey with the numbers, as every time they come out with a new processor line, they're coming out with a new way of what the numbers actually mean. I highly recommend anybody who's interested in the nitty-gritty to actually take a look at that video and see what Linus thinks about the way AMD and Intel are messing with product numbers. So how do we actually compare CPUs? So we're out there, we're shopping for a new computer. So how do we decide what we want? So if you have one line, it can be hard. So here we have, let's compare an Intel 8-core, Core i7, 10th gen, so 10,700, running at 3.8 gigahertz, or an Intel 14-core, but it's a Core i5, 13th gen, so more recent, at running at 3.5 gigahertz. So the first one has fewer cores, but it's a higher level, but it's an older generation, but it's running faster. And, of course, conversely, the Intel 14-core Core i5 has more cores. It's a lower level, Core i5 as opposed to Core i7. Newer generation, 13th versus 10th generation, and running a little bit slower, 3.5 gigahertz. So what do you do? How do you make up your mind on what is going to be the best between those two processors? Then think about going across manufacturers. So how do we compare an Intel 6-core Core i5 11th gen running at 3.9 gigahertz or an AMD 6-core Ryzen 5 5600 3.7 gigahertz? How do you compare those? Go to university at Google. So you just go to Google or your favorite search engine. You type in Core i5 11600K versus, you know, you put in the exact specification of the CPUs, and you say one versus the other, and you will get a whole bunch of benchmarking sites that come up that will go into some detail telling you about which is better. Here's an example. That first one where we had comparing the 8-core Core i7 versus the 14-core Core i5. Now, most people would tend to look at that and say, well, Core i7 is a better processor than the Core i5. Maybe not. This review came back with it saying that the Core i5 actually outperforms the Core i7 by a significant margin. And this particular one, which I actually like, nanoreview.net, I like the way that they do their comparisons of CPUs, and they come up with key differences between them. Now, some of the things on there, I'm not even going to understand really what it is. Around 43.8 gigabyte per second, a higher theoretical memory bandwidth. I don't have a clue how that really affects things. But you can go in, you can pick out some things and see that, yes, you know, one of them has significantly more advantages over the other. So kind of nice, you can get that comparison. How about that other one of going from an Intel and an AMD? And you can see that these ones, they're pretty much a wash. So if I was looking at two computers, one of them had the Intel Core i5 11th gen, and the other computer had an AMD Ryzen 5, I could say they're both the equivalent in terms of the CPU performance that I'm going to get out of it. So I would then move on to comparing other things about those particular computers to see which one I actually wanted to go with. And in this one here, you can see the advantages. You know, one has some advantages, the other has some other advantages. Some of it may make sense to you, and you may be able to say, okay, that particular advantage is important to me. But other than that, you look at it, they're both going to perform pretty much the same. Cost for the processor as part of the overall computer can be a significant portion of it. So the top two in red, they are looking at, you know, the sort of mainstream Core i5, Ryzen 5, and I'm looking at two that actually scored about the same in performance. The Intel is significantly more expensive than the AMD. And likewise, if you go right to the high end, so Core i9 versus a Ryzen 9, again, both of them scoring about the same, so they've got the same performance characteristics. And again, you can see that the Intel processor is more expensive by a significant degree over top of the AMD. So the takeaway from that is if you want to save some money, you might want to navigate towards or gravitate towards AMD as opposed to Intel. I'm not saying Intel is bad. It's just that manufacturers do have to pay more for Intel processors rather than AMD processors. And so keep that in mind. And if you want, just for laughs, if you look at really at the top of it, a Ryzen Pro Threadripper, 64 cores, supports up to 2 terabytes of RAM, $7,300. That's just for the processor. Or the top of the line, Intel Xeon Platinum, $51,000. And I swear that I think that the big thing on both of these is that one of them supports up to 2 terabytes of RAM. The Intel supports up to 4.5 terabytes of RAM. This is data center work. This is probably stuff that is like super, super high computational needs. They have huge data sets that have to be held in memory, and they're willing to pay $51,000 for a processor to be able to handle it all. Okay, now we get into something a little bit new, and this is throwing a really wrench into it as well. This is new to my process, my talk on computers. So ARM. So it's new for Windows. It is a very popular architecture for smartphones and tablets. A lot of smartphones and tablets use ARM processors. They have very good battery life and overall efficiency when you compare them to both Intel and AMD processors, also known as x86 architecture. So Apple has moved completely to ARM processors. So they did iPhone, iPad, MacBook starting back in 2020, and the Mac Pro, which is their desktop, June of 2023, all of their computers are now running ARM processors. ARM actually just does licensing of the architecture to any company that wants to build processors. And there are dozens of manufacturers that have licensed their technology. So what has that got to do with Windows? It's all about Copilot plus PCs. So that's Microsoft's branding for any computers that have next-gen artificial intelligence functions built in. In order for something to be considered to be a Copilot Plus PC, it has to have a neural processing unit with at least 40 trillion operations per second, have at least 16 gigs of RAM, and have at least a 256 SSD. Microsoft claims that this is up to 20 times more powerful than an x86 processor for artificial intelligence workloads and up to 100 times more efficient than x86 processors for specific AI tasks that you might have going on. So the most common processor architecture for Copilot Plus is ARM. It was introduced in June of last year. And there are two processors out there now that are available on Copilot PCs. Watch this when you are looking for computers, because you will see them listed as just alongside all the other x86 processors, but they will specify Copilot Plus PC, and they will specify that is Snapdragon X or Snapdragon X Plus or Elite processor. So it'll actually list it there, but there are some gotchas that you got to watch out for on this. So the fly in the ointment for ARM-based PCs right now is, first off, Copilot Plus, currently only laptop computers. They will come to desktops for sure, but right now you can only get a laptop in Copilot Plus. Keep in mind that for 39 years, Windows applications have run on x86 architecture. So that's basically the AMDs and the Intel world. ARM is the first Copilot Plus branded PCs. It is not x86 architecture. That has some implications. So in order for it to, a program to actually run on an ARM processor, the software vendors can either recode their programs or and then recompile them for the architecture, which is not always simple, not always straightforward, and not always doable. Or they can run it under emulation, where the ARM processor will mimic an x86 processor. The mimicking is not perfect. So you do take a performance hit anytime you run anything under emulation, and not all programs can run under emulation. And that's where the biggest problem is right now when it comes to the ARM PCs. So Microsoft claims over 90% of the time spent in programs compiled for ARM, including a whole bunch of ones, and many others. Note that they didn't say 90% of all apps are native ARM. 90% of time is spent on it. Well, that goes to stand to reason when you say things like Chrome, you know, browser. We spend so much time in our browser. Yeah, all of the browsers are available as native ARM applications, but there's lots of other applications that are out there. Qualcomm does list out native ARM apps on their website, so you can look that up and see whether the apps that you use are available for ARM. Many non-native apps will run using emulation, and PC Magazine had a good article on some testing they did where they tested 31 popular applications and found out which ones ran and which ones didn't run. For the next while, you're going to find some apps that you might depend on will not run on a Copilot Plus PC that is using an ARM processor. Even the Google Drive app that synchronizes your files between your computer and the cloud, for the longest time, it was not available as neither a native ARM or under emulation. It just did not run. I think they corrected that around November, that they finally got the Google Drive app running as, I believe they're running it as a native ARM compilation now. But you're going to run into that probably where you'll run some program that you used to be able to run, you try to run it, and it just doesn't work. And that's going to happen for a period of time. So should you choose x86 or an ARM processor? Well, there are Copilot Plus PCs, you know, using Qualcomm Snapdragon ARM processors that were first introduced last June. They have very long battery life. They have really good performance, quite frankly, for native ARM apps. They do have artificial intelligence capabilities, but it's still in a work in progress, shall we say, in terms of having that mean anything to the average person. And you may have software compatibility problems. So make sure the programs you really depend on do run on an ARM processor before you buy one of those PCs. Now, there are Copilot PCs powered by Intel and AMD, and there'll be more coming along the line. So the two that are out there, Intel has their Core Ultra series, so the 200V series. They are Copilot Plus capable. If you want to stick with x86 architecture and still get the AI capabilities, AMD has the Ryzen AI 300 series and the Pro 300 series processors. They first just appeared in November, and so they're really, really the new kids on the block. They are compatible with all Windows 11 applications that are out there, so you don't end up with that particular problem. The initial releases, they say, are not supporting all Copilot features. And this is right from the word of Microsoft, where they say Copilot Plus PC experiences are coming. Requires free updates, available starting late November 2024. Timing varies by device and region. I happen to have one of these PCs, and I've yet to see anything come along that said they are adding in some feature that is available as a Copilot Plus experience. So who knows what's going to happen on that front. I don't think that we're going to gain the battery life that ARM has. ARM has fantastic battery life. So if you get those Snapdragon-based PCs, you'll end up with, you know, you'll be able to run days and days on battery using it as just normal operational sort of thing. You will get improvements over previous processors, but it's not going to be anywhere near as dramatic as what we see on ARM. So comparing the x86 and ARM CPUs, perhaps, you know, look at both of them, pick them on the strengths and weaknesses. So look at the battery life. Is that really important to you? Aim towards the ARM. Overall performance assessments, right now ARM is still winning in that regard. App compatibility, x86 is winning on that. So if you really need app compatibility, either verify every application you want to run or stick with x86 just as a default. So ARM currently has two options for Copilot Plus PCs, both Snapdragon, so one's the X Plus and one's the X Elite. And then the x86 options, Intel has their Core Ultra 200 V-series, and AMD has the Ryzen AI 300 series and Pro 300 series. Okay, now we're going to move on to looking at some of the other things in the built into the computer. So memory requirements. I think that, you know, Windows 7 through 10 really remained pretty similar, which was actually unusual because normally when you got a new version of Windows, you know, memory requirements went up, processing capability went up, the requirements went up, storage went up, everything. But memory requirements stayed pretty much the same through 7 through 10, which I think was rather remarkable. Windows 11, I think, pretty much doubled the requirements. So if we look at Windows 8 and 10, Microsoft's statement on minimum requirement was 2 gigabytes. I would not want to run a PC running Windows 8 or 10 on 2 gigabytes of RAM. I don't think you would call it running. I think you might call it walking or crawling. Windows 11, Microsoft says the minimum is 4 gigabytes. I say, and the green and the yellow are my numbers, and I think you'll get okay performance on, you know, Windows 10 PC if you have 4 gigabytes of RAM. Nothing screaming, but not bad. And then Windows 11, same sort of thing, but you require 8 gigabytes to get that performance. And then to get good performance, really on Windows 10, 8 gigabytes or more was a lot. And 16 gigabytes or more is really required at that level for Windows 11. What do we mean by minimum, okay, and best? Minimum, I think just if you just can't spend the money on anything more, very light computing, because if you throw much at it, it's going to really bog down. Okay, if you're mostly web browsing, word processing, some light gaming, not the first-person shoot-'em-up gaming that the youngins play, but, you know, this some light gaming, not bad. You get by with that. And then the best is really getting into video editing or advanced photo editing. Basic photo editing could follow into the orange. Having a lot of apps open at the same time, or advanced computing, really look at those numbers as being 8 gigabytes for Windows 10. And seeing as we're looking now at Windows 11 computers is really what we're going to be looking at, 16 gigs or more if you really want good performance. And, whoops, sorry. Oh, geez. Where is my thing? There we go. I lost my advancing. There we go. Okay, storage. So internal storage, laptops, the vast majority of them will have a single solid-state drive in them. Very few laptop computers anymore have spinning hard drives. That goes right from really budget PCs up to powerhouses. You'll find solid-state. Typically, you'll run around 512 gigabytes up to 1 terabyte. Really avoid 128 gigabyte. If you go with 128 gigabyte, you end up with problems even, you know, the once-a-year feature update to Windows is a major update, and it takes a lot of space to install it. You probably are going to have a problem doing that at all. 256 gig, you can get away with it, but it's not a lot of space for you. So I say typically you should be looking at 512 or 1 terabyte as what you're going to be looking for on a laptop. On the desktop, most have a solid-state drive now on new computers, and most of them, it's at least 512 gigabytes. Some will have a combination where they'll put in a 512 gigabyte or 1 terabyte solid-state drive and a hard drive, 1 or 2 terabytes or something like that. And what you can do is put on the spinning hard drive stuff that you don't need great performance on, and keep the operating system and your programs and any data that you need very fast reads and writes on, keep that on the solid-state drive. For external storage, it's really great for both desktops and laptops for doing backup and adding storage. Now, I say it's mostly useful for desktops for adding storage because if you start adding external storage on the laptop computer, you're all of a sudden going to be taking away your portability, which is one of the big advantages of having that. So think about it. You have a bunch of important files in that. They're stored on that. You unplug it. You move over to your friend's house or something like that to use the computer. And then all of a sudden you go, oh, that file I need is on that external hard drive that is on my desk at home. So desktop drives capacities run anywhere from about 2 terabytes up to 20 terabytes. And you can get portable drives that run about 1 terabyte to 5 terabytes. The nice thing about them is you don't need an external power supply for it. It will actually get the power through the USB cable. I find it really useful for offsite backups because when you bring it in to your house to do backup of your computers, you don't have to worry about, oh, where can I plug this into a power outlet? You just have to plug in the data cable and you're good to go. When you've done your backup, you take the drive, unplug it, put it back in offsite. And so it's really, really good for that, I find. You can also get solid-state drives that are external, and the capacities are generally around 1 terabyte to 4 terabytes. They tend to be a little bit more expensive, but the prices are coming down on those, and they are really, really handy because they're so small, like you can put them in a shirt pocket or whatever. So there are some other options when it comes to external storage. You can use things like flash drives and memory cards. They're inexpensive, but they usually don't have very large capacities. We're running 4 gigabytes is hard to come by nowadays. You're probably talking 8 to 16 gigabytes up to 256 gigabytes. You can get some flash drives that are a little bit bigger and things like that. They're typically very slow on reading and writing, and they're really not designed for constant writing, and so they can wear out and they can fail. But they can be a no-cost option if you can reuse something you've got lying around, and they can be really useful for a very limited backup, file backup, so you can just, you know, copy some files off to it, disconnect it from your computer, and then put it somewhere safe. It's really great for transferring things from one computer to another computer. And it can be very useful to have a bootable flash drive so that you can start up your computer from that and have utilities on it that is able to fix problems in an unworking computer. Video cards or graphics cards. You can have both integrated graphics or dedicated and discrete graphics cards. So the integrated graphics will use part of your RAM. So if you have a 16 gigabyte computer, it will use some of that 16 gigabytes for its video operations. It's done mostly for cost savings, so it is cheaper to run with integrated graphics than to do a dedicated graphics card. But for most people, I think that that's entirely appropriate. You don't need more than integrated graphics, and it doesn't take that much of your RAM that you can't give some of it up to do the video operations. You can get dedicated or discrete graphics cards, and they have onboard memory, typically anywhere from about 2 to 8 gigabytes of RAM that is specifically done just for the graphics operations. They are more expensive, and they may actually be required for certain operations. So advanced video editing, advanced photo editing, gaming certainly, a lot of the high-end games will actually require a dedicated video card. Make sure you check the software that you're going to be using to see if the requirements say that a dedicated video card is required. The video or the photo editing software that I use on OneFoto Raw, it actually specifies it requires a dedicated video card with at least 4 gigabytes of video RAM on it. If you think you need a dedicated video card, I say research it because you may not. And it can add an awful lot of cost to the computer, and you may see absolutely no benefit by going to a dedicated video card. So I would say only worry about it if you have software that actually requires it.
And Chris, Tristan is noting that right now dedicated GPUs are crazy prices in general.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reason why that is the NVIDIA in particular, a lot of them are being bought up by either miners for cryptocurrency or AI processing, which can use GPUs to speed things along. So, yeah, it really goes up and down an awful lot. Right now, you're right. Yeah, the prices on discrete GPUs can actually be pretty expensive. And, yeah, GPUs will use more power and generate more heat. That's not to say you can't do it in a laptop. My laptops actually have dedicated video cards on them, and they do use more battery and generate more heat. So it's a little bit harder for the manufacturer to actually build a laptop where it can deal with that heat dissipation problems. And, yeah, Tristan says best bang for the buck seems to be the most recent Intel GPU. Yeah. Yeah, the ARC graphics built into their latest processors seem to be getting some pretty good reviews. Okay, getting information in and out of the video. So you have the video port. And so modern computers will either have HDMI or DisplayPort or both. And both of them can handle video as well as audio. So if you have a monitor that has built-in speakers, you can actually have the speakers powered by the HDMI or DisplayPort. HDMI is often used for other things, so for televisions, projectors, game consoles, things like that. DisplayPort is used, I've only seen it for between a PC and a monitor. So you don't see DisplayPort being used for TVs and things like that. A lot of modern laptops can also output video signals through a Type-C USB port, which will then adapt to either HDMI or DisplayPort or whatever you actually need. There are still legacy ports around. So VGA and DVI are the two big ones that you'll still come across. On monitors is where you'll see them. And because monitors can outlast computers, you may have a monitor right now that you're going to replace the computer, but you don't want to replace the monitor. And it may have VGA or DVI ports on it that you'll have to adapt to. Not a problem. So here's that chart of the uses, and you see how HDMI is used for a lot of things, and DisplayPort really just used for monitors and computers. Let's look at the capabilities and the release dates. Don't worry too much about this, because if you are buying a new computer, it is almost certainly going to have HDMI 2.1 and or DisplayPort 2.0 or 2.1. Okay? You can see the capabilities as they went into newer generations. A lot of it was the higher resolution or the higher refresh rates was what they got in higher standards. So in new computers, it's almost certain that you're going to end up with any of the blue ones there. Now, you might think, oh, well, I'll look for a DisplayPort 2.1 versus a DisplayPort 2.0. Don't worry about that. It turns out that Visa, which is the licensing body behind DisplayPort, they did a lot of work with manufacturers, and they actually went back and they made sure that all devices that were certified for DisplayPort 2.0 actually meet the specification requirements for DisplayPort 2.1. So if you see something out there with DisplayPort 2.0 on it, don't worry about it. It'll actually handle all of the specs for 2.1. And the 2.1 specs are really a spec. A little bit longer cable lengths, some little bit more robust in the signaling and some things like that. But DisplayPort 2.0, apparently, it meets all those requirements as well. Kind of strange, but true. If you have to convert video ports, not a problem. You can go HDMI to DisplayPort. You can go a Type-C to DisplayPort or a Type-C to HDMI. Or Type-C to VGA. You can get splitters. So you can type in on an HDMI and split it out to two or three or four HDMI displays or DisplayPort. Plug in once, and then you have up to four, in this case, different displays you can plug into there. You got to have HDMI to VGA, DisplayPort to VGA. There's all the port matching that you need is out there, and they're relatively inexpensive. These are like $15-$20 items. The splitters tend to be a little bit more expensive, but not an awful lot. Multi-monitor. Multi-monitor is really kind of neat. It's the ability to output to multiple displays. And so you can either have every display show the same content, or you can extend your desktop across the multiple displays so you increase the real estate. Almost all laptops, I don't think I've ever seen a laptop that doesn't have this. It'll have the built-in display, of course, and you will have at least one external monitor through a port, either through a dedicated probably HDMI, possibly DisplayPort, or a Type-C that you can use a dongle that will then connect to either DisplayPort or HDMI. You can have many desktops, three or more possible displays on there, and then you can extend through a splitter if you have just one or two ports on your computer. You can use a splitter to increase the number of displays that you can actually use.
So Kareem's asking how reliable converters and splitters are.
I've never had a problem with it. I haven't heard anybody who has problems with it. The one thing you'll have to watch for, I guess, a little bit is that if you're running a 4K monitor, I would make sure that you have a splitter that is actually specifies that it is good for 4K or something like that. But I've never actually run into a problem with it. Oh. I guess Bob Harris picked up a spelling mistake on mine.
Regarding what can be supported, in general, the USB-C, many monitors will take USB-C as for a video input, okay. and that up to 4K. As for HDMI, I think 2.0 is 4K and more. 2.1 is something like 8K or two 4K monitors or something. The bandwidth on USB 4 and Thunderbolt is upwards of 40 gigabits a second. I think you only need about 10 gigabits a second for a 4K monitor.
Yeah. I did have one situation where I tried to do a triple monitor, and it was a laptop, a 4K monitor, and I tried to add another 4K monitor, and it just wouldn't work. I went down to a 2K monitor, and it did work. So there are some limitations that are going to come into play at some point in time. A lot of that, I think, came down to actually the video card was only capable of putting out enough for that. So as you get into trying to do too many monitors, you may end up running into some limitations that it just doesn't work. You're not going to end up with an easy answer for any of that. If I have, the following, what will it do and what won't it do?
I have a USB 3 converter for USB to VGA. And for the VGA, it needs USB 3 bandwidth. So that's 5 gigabits a second. So something more than the 480 megabits per second that a USB 2 provides.
Okay. So I guess the lesson is there are some limitations that might come to bite you, but in general, if you're going to modest size and just one or two displays, you might not be too bad off. But, yeah, check it out, I guess. So connections to the external displays does vary. So you will have HDMI and DisplayPort. You may end up with monitors that use DVI and VGA and will have to do the conversion to those.
Can I ask one question about these adapters? So
if you're
coming in with a HDMI and you're using a converter to go to a USB, your computer is going to know that it's a monitor coming in. But can you do something else? Like, can you read that HDMI signal?
If you're going out an HDMI from your computer, you're not going to be going to a USB.
No, let's say you're coming out of, say, a DVD player, for example.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know. You know, trying to get output from something like that, I don't know. I'm only looking at the computer side of it, getting signal out from the computer to a display. So
I was asking is because at the last Q&A, someone was asking about how to transfer their DVD. So if you could,
right,
if you could play it on a DVD player,
yeah,
come out with from there with an HDMI, convert it to a USB, and then read it, and then read it, you might be able to do it that way, right?
Yeah, I have no experience with that whatsoever, unfortunately. So can't help you on that one.
One of the things you can do there is to use a video capture device, which will export from the DVD and import into the PC.
Okay. That's a good one, Alan. Thank you. Last one on this slide. Some laptops actually have Miracast, which will allow you to do a wireless connection to a display. Typically, the way people use that is go out to their big screen TV in the family room or whatever. I, quite frankly, have not been very happy with Miracast, and I find that more often than not, it drops the connection periodically, and you have to reconnect it, and I've had nothing but frustration with using Miracast. If you have different experience, good on you, but my personal experience, I say don't count on it. Webcams. So this, again, I said before, I have an inordinate number of slides here on webcams, but I thought there was some interesting differences that were not really apparent to me when I first started looking at webcams. So laptops, I think they all have webcams. I don't know of any that don't have a webcam built in. Desktops never have a webcam because they just have the system unit and a keyboard and a mouse, and that's all. You can easily add a webcam to either desktop PC or a laptop if you don't like the one that was included with the laptop. Your common resolutions, 720p, 1080p, and 4K. I think that for most people, 4K is overkill. All you're doing is you're forcing an awful lot of more data that is being processed and so forth. So I think that the sweet spot is really the 1080p if you want a high res, and if you don't care about higher resolution, 720p may be perfectly adequate for you. Frame rates go from about 30 frames a second up to about 120 frames a second, and if you have a higher frame rate, you'll get less jerky motion. So other people looking at your video feed, they'll see it as smooth motion rather than having a jerky movement to it. If you go to higher frame rates, usually you end up having to go to lower resolution. So you're not going to get, for example, a 4K doing 120 frames per second. You know, if you want 4K, you're probably going to end up, you know, dropping down to 60 frames per second. Or if you want 120 frames a second, you're going to have to drop down to full HD, 1080p, or maybe even 720p. Field of view is something that I never thought about until I ran into webcams that had different fields of view, and I didn't even realize this was a capability or a restriction. So there are three that are commonly out there, 60 degrees, which is good for a single person sitting in front of it, doing, you know, a Zoom or whatever. 78 degrees, which is good for two people, you know, to be able to see both of them. And then 90 degrees, it's good if you have a group of people. Why is that important? If you buy a 90 degree and you're going to be using it for a single person, you're going to see something more like you see my picture right now, where I'm really small in the frame, you know, as opposed to, say, Tom, who's very large in the frame. I suspect that Tom has Tom has probably a 60 degree angle view, and I think mine is 78 degrees, but I'm not sure. Autofocus, almost all webcams will have autofocus, or they will have a fixed focus that covers everything from about, you know, a foot and a half to infinity. You will get faster autofocus and better subject detection on higher end webcams. The lower end ones, you might get it where all of a sudden you're out of focus and you have to do things like putting your hand up to the camera, getting it to focus on that, and then backing off, and then finally it'll focus on your face. So, yeah, better autofocus is great, and you tend to get that in the higher end of the webcams. You get built-in microphones. Almost all webcams will have at least one, and a lot of them will have dual microphones. I'm not sure how much more natural a sound it is with dual microphones when they're about 1 inch apart, but that's what they claim. And I think that if you want the best sound, consider getting a headset. I particularly like this kind of headset where it's for call centers, where it's only one ear is covered and you have the boom microphone. So I hear ambient sounds still going on around me, but I have good sound going into the headset, and using a boom microphone in a headset will allow other people to get much clearer sound, less echo, more noise cancellation, things like that. You can get privacy shutters on the one in the picture that has a little shutter that can go down so that if you're worried about a hacker coming in and activating your webcam, you know, you can flip that down. If you don't have that, get a piece of cardboard and tape, and you can just tape it across the top and flip it out when you want to use the webcam, flip it down over top of the lens when you want privacy. Most of them have, or a lot of them, will have mounts where you can mount them on a mini tripod. So if you don't want it sitting way up above your, at the top of your monitor or whatever, you can just put it onto a little mini tripod. And a lot of them will come with software controls. And this tends to be a little bit on the higher end, but they'll come with software that you can download. Usually it doesn't come in the box. And it'll allow you to control things like potentially zooming, but also panning side to side, tilting up and down without having to move the actual webcam itself, adjusting brightness, contrast, things like that. And some of them will come with Windows sign-in, so they will have Windows Hello for facial recognition. The one I'm using right now actually does have that. So on a desktop computer, I find it really handy. I now have Windows Hello sign-in. I never have to type in my password anymore. Optical
drone. Before you move on there,
yep.
Chris, Tristan notes that you can now get webcams that have an integrated ring light.
Oh, cool.
And he notes the Razer Kiyo.
Oh, neat. Yeah. Yeah, for the people who want to be on Zoom and things like that, it definitely can give you a much better appearance to your face to the other people if you use a ring light, for sure. Cool.
And Stu's asking if you have any experience with bone conduction headphones.
I have no experience with that. I've heard of them, but I don't know anybody who has one, and I have not read anything on just how people, whether they like it, or whether it works well or not. Absolutely no experience, sorry. Okay, optical drives. Used to be a big deal. Not so much anymore. It used to be that when you bought a new piece of software, you went down to your local computer store, you bought a box, and it had a CD or a DVD in it, and you brought it home, and you needed to have a CD or a DVD reader in order to load the software. Now we just load all our software, download it off the internet. It's very rare that you'll actually use this. But if you do need it, you do often get DVD burners on desktops. And they're actually becoming rare on desktops. So I've noticed more and more new desktops are not including a DVD burner on them. But they are more common, certainly, than on laptops. On laptops, some of the larger laptops will still have DVD burners on them, or potentially even a Blu-ray, usually a reader. But they are becoming rarer as well. And it just takes up a lot of space and weight in a laptop that most manufacturers realize, you know, very few people actually use them anymore. And if you do need one, you can get an external one that plugs into a USB port, and they're cheapest chips. You can get them for $20-25. And they work perfectly fine for the few times that you actually need them. Okay, USB ports. And this is a bit of a bugaboo on that I have with USB. There's so many different standards. We love standards. There's so many to choose from. So USB stands for the Universal Serial Bus, and it is the way of getting information in and out of computers nowadays. Generally, you'll have anywhere from 1 to 8 ports. Usually you'll have 2 or 3, going up to 8, sometimes a few more on desktops. I mentioned front and rear because if you have a desktop computer, you'll have some ports that are up front, and you'll have a whole bunch of ports in the rear. Take a look at how you use your computer, what you need to plug into it, and make sure that you have, in particular, ports up front for things that you want to be able to easily plug in and unplug from your computer. You don't need to plug and unplug your keyboard and mouse frequently, so they can get plugged into the back. If you run out of ports in the front and you go to plug in a flash drive and you have to crawl around to put this flash drive into the back of your computer, you're going to find that really old really quick. So take a look at the distribution of what ports they have where. My current computer, USB Type-C, the only ones are in the back. I do not have a USB Type-C up front. That is going to come to bug me at some point in time, I am sure. You do get a limited number of ports on thin and light laptops and tablets. Tablets, it'll typically be one port. Thin laptops and things like that, usually you'll get two or three. Some will have four, and it'll be a distribution of different types. You can use them for data transfer as well as power delivery if they are power delivery capable. You can see in the diagram there's a little lightning bolt type symbol. That is an indication that it is power delivery capable. And there are different standards of the amount of power you can actually put through there, but at least you know that you do have the capability of doing power in or out. Multiple flavors. So USB 2, which is the oldest you'll find still kicking around. 480 megabits per second, 2.5 watts as the power. That is perfectly appropriate for keyboard, mouse, that sort of thing. USB Type 3.x has faster speeds, 5 to 20 gigabits per second, and more power is available, 4.5 to 15 watts. And you can get those in either Type A or Type C connectors. And then you get into the USB 4. It goes 40 to 80 gigabits per second, and that is Type-C connectors only. And USB power delivery will actually do 100 to 240 watts, which is a lot of power, and those are over Type-C connectors only. Audio ports. In a desktop computer, you'll usually have these three. And so you have microphone for getting sound into the computer, a line out for speakers or headphones, and a line in for things like a media player. On laptops, you usually get a combination port, so it'll handle both microphone for getting sound in and audio out through for a headset or external speakers or something like that.
What people, Chris, noted about USB is that you can also use a hub.
Yeah, you can. You're going to end up with some weird limitations on certain when you get into power delivery and things like that. I wouldn't want to be playing around with trying to do power delivery through a USB hub. Your hub is probably not going to be capable of handling it. But if you have fairly simple requirements like flash drives, a printer, a USB-based headset, things like that, they could definitely run off of a hub if you're running out of ports, and those can be a really inexpensive solution for that sort of thing. Look for whether you need a powered hub, because some devices, like a keyboard and mouse, you don't need a powered hub typically, but if you have an external hard drive, you may need a powered hub. So you have to figure that out on the devices that you actually use. Oh, I see. Fancy USB hubs can handle power delivery. I would definitely, if you need that, make sure your hub specifies that it handles power delivery to the level of power that you actually want to pump through it.
Yep, and you also need special cables for something, I think over 30 watts, and I'm not sure. Maybe over 60, but it needs an actual chip inside the cable to handle the power delivery, because it actually communicates you can also, but they're fairly cheap. I mean, I have a cable that actually shows the power delivery up to 240 watts, so it definitely has a chip in it. But they're only like $14 or $15, so it's not that expensive.
I actually did buy a USB cable to go along with my power brick. And it was specifically, I think it said it handled up to 200 watt or something like that. So if you are buying cables, and they will specify if they do, if they are power capable. But I don't know anything that doesn't specify it. I don't know. It's I don't know enough about this sort of stuff to really know the nitty gritty. I just try to buy what I think is going to be the maximum needs I'm going to have for it.
Also, USB-C cables are funny. They can come in different power delivery, as we've been talking about, but also in different ability to communicate information, whether they're limited to USB 2 speeds at 480 megabits, which sounds like a lot, but but the fastest cables can run up to 40 gigabits or even, I think, 80 gigabits for USB 4. And, of course, they cost more.
Okay. I just noticed the time here, and I've been negligent on watching the time, and I'm going to have to start racing through things. So card readers, you know, they're often in laptops as well as desktops. Different formats. SD is very common. You can get ones with other formats, and you can get external card readers that if you need one and your computer doesn't have it, whether it's a desktop or a laptop. Desktop networking, typically you will get wired gigabit Ethernet. Some will go up to 2.5 gigabit Ethernet. Some desktops will have Wi-Fi as well, either Wi-Fi 5 or Wi-Fi 6. You're now getting into the Wi-Fi 7 as well. On the laptop, typically you get wireless 5, 6, or 7, and typically nowadays you'll see either 6 or 7. On some laptops, you can actually get wired Ethernet, and if you need wired Ethernet and your laptop doesn't have it or your desktop doesn't have it for some reason, you can get a USB Type A or Type C to Ethernet adapter to do wired networking. Some things on the wireless standards. So if you want to look up, you know, the speed capabilities, the different Wi-Fi standards, all that sort of stuff, and the frequency ranges they run on and so forth, that has all of the numbers for you. For printers, inkjet or laser are the two technologies that are available. Inkjet, you'll get inexpensive hardware. You might get a printer for $50-75, and it's actually a very good, capable printer. Where they kill you is the ink. It's the most, one of the most expensive fluids on the face of the earth, and you will get good to excellent quality, especially printing photos. You're going to want to be on inkjet for good quality prints for sure. You should print at least weekly to prevent clogged ink printheads. On the laser side, you get moderately priced hardware. You won't get $50 lasers, but you can get them $100 to $150. The toner is relatively inexpensive, and you will get good to excellent quality. And if you do want color, it can get pretty expensive on that side. You have multiple toner cartridges that are required, so if you're faced with replacing all of your toner cartridges, it can be a big bill. So special form factor computers, we're actually getting close to the end here. So thin and light used to be called Ultrabook, and that was a trademark of Intel. You have convertible hybrids, all-in-ones, tablets, Chromebooks, gaming, ducks, and single-board computers. So the thin and light, very high-performance computers, they tend to be on the expensive side. You can expect to spend well over $1,000 for it and up to $2,000 or more. They are very powerful, have good capable processors, lots of memory, large capacity solid-state drives. They will all have Wi-Fi, and sometimes they'll have wired networking as well. 2 to 4 USB ports, video, webcam, all the rest of it. Card readers sometimes. Battery life is generally very good on these particular computers. On the convertible hybrids, they can be used as a laptop or as a tablet. So the one on the left, you can actually detach the display, and the guts of the computer are in the display portion, and so the keyboard is just separate. It may have additional battery in the keyboard portion as well. Or you can get the one like in the middle, where just the screen flips around completely to use it as a tablet, or the one on the right where you swivel it and then lie it down over top of the keyboard. They are somewhat more expensive than a regular laptop, but if you want that convertibility to use it as a tablet as well as using it as a laptop, it might be a good option for you. So you can get all-in-ones, and they're essentially a big laptop, and I look at them as being a niche product because they have all the disadvantages of a desktop. So it's large, it's not portable, and you have to have it plugged in. It has all the disadvantages of a laptop. It has confined space, so the heat, you can't upgrade it as easily, things like that, and it is much higher cost. So to me, there are case you know, use cases for them, but really look at it critically because it really is disadvantages on both sides. Tablets, usually they're running Android rather than Windows, but there are exceptions to that, such as Microsoft Surface devices, their tablets. I find that they're great for if you're just consuming information. If you're just browsing the web, just reading emails, things like that, great. not so great if you're creating information. A small email might not be too bad. I would not want to write War and Peace on a tablet. Keyboards and mice are some of the most popular accessories that you get for tablets. But if you add in a keyboard and a mouse, haven't you just turned it into a laptop? Maybe you're better off just looking for a laptop if you really have that use case where you're going to want to use a keyboard and a mouse. Chromebooks are laptops that run Google's Chrome OS, and they can't run Windows programs. So there's lots of programs that are in the Chrome store, but realize that you can't run Windows programs. They are inexpensive usually. You can get very expensive Chromebooks as well, but they tend to be a little bit cheaper than you'll find Windows laptops. Low performance to very capable. And by low performance, I mean they can really suck. I have a Chromebook that has 4 gigs of RAM, and that thing is swapping out from memory all the time. I would never buy a Chromebook again that has only 4 gigabytes of RAM. They do have an online focus. It used to be you pretty much had to be connected to the internet in order to use a Chromebook, but now there are a lot of things you can do offline, locally installed applications, and locally store your data much more freely. Gaming PCs, very high performance, especially for graphics, heavy duty on the graphics side. Just as a benchmark of the top end, this is a Falcom Northwest Talon 24-core 48-thread processor, 128 gigs of RAM, 4 terabytes of solid-state drive that is really fast, NVIDIA RTX 4090 with 24 gigabytes of video RAM. Video card alone costs $2,500, 12 USB ports for the low, low price of US, $10,569. PC Magazine rated it best of the year in 2022, and they had only one con on this one. May require a second mortgage. NUX is the next unit of computing, is where the name came from, and it was actually designed by Intel in 2013. Very small form factor PCs, a little box. It's very, very small. And Intel decided they're getting out of the NUX market. Starting in July 2023, they were getting out of the market. But there are other vendors that are still marketing, which is kind of interesting. So it delivers the full desktop PC experience. So you have everything, processor, memory, your storage, a wired LAN or Wi-Fi, integrated or discrete graphics, all of it built into these little tiny boxes. Really cool. And brand new, Asus is the first in the world for a Copilot Plus NUC. And that's just announced for 2025. Look at it. It's got a Core Ultra processor, up to 32 gigs of RAM, up to 2 terabytes solid state, HDMI, Wi-Fi 7, 2.5 gigabit Ethernet, Bluetooth, all kinds of USB ports, speaker, microphone outputs, everything like that. I went to the Asus website, and it's either that it is really bloody expensive or it's not yet available. They do not have a buy now button. They do have a ask for a quote button on their website. So if you're really interested, you can ask for a quote on one of their NUCs. Single board computers, this goes to the other end of the spectrum where from the gaming PCs, Raspberry Pi and BeagleBoard are the two biggest names, I guess, in that. Very inexpensive. You can get a Raspberry Pi Zero for $5 US. It's a little bit of a draw in there. The Zero really means something there. It comes with no networking capabilities at all and some other restrictions. But you can get Raspberry Pis for Canadian under $50. You can get them. They usually have ARM processors, but some of them are x86, and not so much RISC-V, but there are some. Typically, they run Linux. Very low power consumption. They have HDMI, Wi-Fi, Ethernet. They have general purpose input/output. A lot of people use these for controlling other devices, and so that's what uses that general purpose input/output. And a lot of people use it for learning programming, robotics, things like that. Backups, make sure you have them. Image backups are certainly the thing that most people should make sure they have, so they have complete disaster recovery. Use it with a high-capacity USB drive to store your disk images because they can be really big. You want to be able to have room for multiple backups on that drive if possible. Allows you to archive huge, huge amounts of data. for folder and file synchronization for the active folders, things that get frequently updated. You can use things like file history, where you can get real-time backup, where as you create or modify files, they are backed up immediately, and file versioning, which will allow you to go back to years-old versions of any particular file and get back a previous version. So how do you narrow down the field? So get a good idea of the features that you absolutely need and the ones you would like to have. So go through all of the slides that I presented so far and say, what do you need on each of those slides that is really important to you? And then what are the things you think, well, that'd be cool if I can get it for, you know, either the same price or not much extra. I'd be willing to pay a little bit extra to get this particular feature. But if I can find a good PC without it, I don't really worry about it. Look for the makes and models that have those particular features that you're looking for. There are lots of reviews that are available out there online. So Google can help you find categories. So this is kind of cool where you can go best laptops of 2024. And that's what I Google for, best laptops 2024. And there were a number of reputable places like PC World that came up with these reviews of multiple models that came out. And So you can read those and get an idea of the sort of things that are out there on the market at this particular point in time. Or go to your favorite computer store. Or look for computers that have your required and desired features on them. Talk to fellow OPCUG members. See what they have to say. Talk to them about what your requirements are, the type of computing you do, how many devices you need to be able to plug into it. Ask them what they use, what they like, what they didn't like. Once you find something interesting, then Google it and just add the word review. And so this case here, I went to HP Dragonfly G4 and said review. And Paul Thurrott, well-known pundit on Windows computing, been around for many years, very trusted. He's very opinionated, but he'll expose why he's opinionated certain ways. And so start reading it. When I look at reviews, usually the first thing I skip to is the end. I'll look for recommendations, conclusions, and any pros and cons. If I go and I see through the recommendations and conclusions and the pros and cons, and I'm still interested in it, then I'll go read the whole review. So in summary, what you want to do is narrow down your choice to either laptop or desktop, then identify your computing needs. You know, is it very light duty? Do you need high power? Do you actually need a dedicated video card? Do you need 4 USB ports? Do you need, you know, multiple external displays connected in, things like that? Keep in mind, most users don't need a separate graphics card. Okay, you'll be wasting money for general computing. I think you'll be wasting money if you spend extra to get a dedicated video card. But there are some use cases where you actually do require it, so make sure if you do require it, make sure your computer includes it. Make provisions for backups. Backups are very, very important. There's the axiom that, you know, there's those who have lost data and those who will lose data. Keep that in mind. Ask your friends and, you know, the OPCUG members and get what thoughts they have. People are usually happy to fill you in on exactly what it is that they like and don't like about a particular computer that they've actually decided on. Consult the reviews. Take them with a grain of salt. And I don't usually go with any one review. I'll go with multiple reviews. If 5 reviewers are saying that the keyboard is really, really bad, then I'll say, okay, it'd probably be really, really bad for me too. If 1 of 5 is saying they didn't like the keyboard, maybe it's not a concern to me. I don't know. I'll just skip over those two. We all know about the Ottawa PC User Group. And that's all, folks. So the presentation is available for downloading as a PDF file, and Alan has posted that into the chat. And with that, I'd take any other questions that people have or comments.
There was one comment earlier on, Chris, which is kind of a summary thing. It's Tristan pointing out that he says the most important factor is determining what you will do with a PC.
Yeah.
If you're only browsing and using Office suites, then basically anything will do. And if it's if it's items like gaming, virtualization, or graphics rendering, then you do need more computing power.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess I touched on that on the memory requirements slide, which was that one there. But it does come into play in the other things too. So if you're in the OK thing where you're web browsing, word processing, light gaming, you don't have to go to a Core i9. You know, Core i5 is probably OK for you on that. So the overall capabilities of the computer, it's more than just the memory requirements. Good point. So good to keep that in mind.
If you have basic requirements like some word editing, some emails, some other stuff like that, including watching videos and stuff like that, you really need a minimum PC. You really don't have to spend a lot. And what really matters then is the keyboard good for you? Can you use it well? Is the screen big enough for you?
Yeah.
Otherwise, everything is fast enough that, I mean, we were running in Viking computers 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that did all these things using a CPU budget of about 1% or less.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I saw a video, apparently the Cray supercomputer that they had in the, 70s or 80s, is now outrun by an Apple iPhone. So things are really fast these days. So just you go into the store and check it out, and if it feels good and the screen is good, and then you try out the things that you want to do, if you can, depends on what's on the demonstration PC.
Yeah.
If it works for you, then that's all you need. You really only need the high end if you're doing like photo or video editing, and gaming. And otherwise, you really only need a minimum kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Don't spend more than you have to. I'm a cheap SOB, and so I spend a lot on my computers, but it's because I need the computing capability. If you don't need the capability, don't spend crazy amounts of money on a PC, because you can get by with budget PCs that are in the $600 range that are perfectly good, PCs. There's not a lot of them, but there are some around the $600 mark, $800 mark, things like that, that for a lot of people are perfectly sufficient, and they're not going to see any benefit. If you're just browsing the web and doing a little bit of word processing, you're not going to get, fantastically capabilities that, you would get with a Core i9. You're not going to see any benefit to that. I see one question here from Glenn. Can you mention what Copilot apps are assisted by an onboard NPU on your personal computer? And that's a really good question, but there's no good answer for it yet. Right now, if you're buying a Copilot PC, other than if you're buying a Snapdragon one and you are getting quite good performance and battery life, if you're not talking about that, if you're talking about strictly its capability of doing neural processing or AI-capable things, the only thing that I know of currently is there's a new feature, and I forget what they called it. Microsoft has this thing where if you want it, it can be watching what you're doing all the time in different apps and things like that, and it can really allow you to roll back to or find what was I doing yesterday afternoon, as opposed to just, what are my files and things like that. That capability is currently available only on Copilot Plus PCs that are running Snapdragon processors. They are not even capable on, like the one that I bought, which is, an AMD AI-capable processor. It still will not run that functionality. In the future, I'm sure there's going to be more and more capabilities that are going to be handed off to the local processor to do the functions if it is an AI-capable processor. It could be image recognition. It could be something as simple as, a Windows Hello will be maybe more accurate or faster or things like that if you have an NPU that can handle those sort of workloads. If you want to get into image modification and things like that, NPUs are going to at some point come into a play. They're not there yet. Unfortunately, if you're buying a PC now, do you buy it with an NPU and you're going to limit your something to a subset of the PCs that are available out there, are you going to buy it with either Snapdragon, where you might have problems with compatibility, or you're going to buy an Intel Ultra or the AMD AI processors, which probably going to cost you a little bit extra, and maybe you'll end up with some capabilities in the future that will benefit you. Right now, you're buying a promise. And I don't know. I suspect that I made a mistake buying a new PC now with an AI processor. But I just decided I needed a new one to replace a laptop that had a screen that had died on me. So I decided, what the heck, I'll take a shot at it. I suspect that I probably spent $500 more than I had to. I could have gotten the equivalent in terms of capabilities of general purpose computing without the promise of AI and saved about $500, probably. So.
I think that rollback feature, Chris, is called Microsoft Recall.
Yes, Recall. That's right. Thank you.
I think if you if you're really interested in running NPUs, then what you need is basically a whole bunch of memory, especially video memory. And if you really want to experiment with downloaded LLMs, which you can download, I mean, you can download very big LLMs. You need lots of memory and a good coprocessor, a good GPU. That's going to cost a bunch of money, and you will need a desktop rather than a laptop, because you're really going to want 128 or 256 gigabytes of RAM, that's, and only some computers will support that. And you will want I think that apparently the 5000 series NVIDIA GPUs are supposed to be good for AI, and not so great for gaming. You'd have to install one or two of those, and you're still looking. You're looking at now about a $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 machine. But if you want to experiment fully with it, that's it. Otherwise, it's just simpler to use the AIs on the web, like Perplexity or Copilot or the other ones, and play around with it that way. Because then it's essentially you can do it on your own personal PC that you have right now.
But there are features like Recall that are only available. That feature, if you want it, you can only get it if you've got a Snapdragon-based PC. And it's just not available on anything else. And there are going to be more things like that coming along. I don't particularly want, you know, Recall. But there are going to be other features like that that they will say, you know, this is going to be processed locally. If you do not have the capability of processing it locally using an AI-capable NPU, then that feature is just not going to be available to you, period. And I think we're going to see more and more of them, but it's going to take some time for them to come out.
Going back to USBs, Chris, Enid's asking, why would you need to do power delivery?
You can use it both ways, where you can actually power the laptop from a USB-C with power delivery. So you plug in a power adapter right into the PC, rather than a dedicated, barrel connector or whatever power connector you would normally have on a laptop, you will actually plug it into a PD-capable USB port. You can also use it to deliver power to other devices, so you could charge your phone or, you know, things like that from the power delivery. Most of the concentration seems to be that people want it to be able to power the laptop from an external power source.
So you can use a USB-C power delivery port and do that. And you can also do it, especially if you have a sort of a thin-and-light laptop with a limited number of ports. You may not want to carry your power brick along with you, in which case you can power it up from a USB-C port. But also, if you're using a dock, most of the docks that have a whole bunch of interfaces on them have a power delivery port that you can plug in, because you're already using your USB for running a monitor and a network and God knows what else. So that you need that USB port is being used up. So if you can have power delivery too, then you don't, then you still have things available. Well, if you have a choice between power delivery or using your other devices, then that's a lousy decision to have to make.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. I see Eldon said, thinking a lot of good used computers available too. As it stands right now, be very careful on it because you could buy a used computer that will only run Windows 10. So make sure at this point in time, if you are buying a used computer, make sure it's capable of running Windows 11. Either already has it on it, or you verify that it can be upgraded for free to Windows 11. But yeah, with that caveat, sure, used computers, you can get some really good deals on it. And there are a couple of outlets around town, like Trailing Edge, that'll stand behind their products. So it's definitely a good way to save some money on that. Alan, if you see anything else that needs talking to, shout out.
I think we've covered most things.
Yeah, the Eldon also asked about Snapdragon processors. The same Snapdragon processors being promoted in many cell phones now. Maybe, maybe not. There are a lot of different Snapdragon processors out there, but there are only two that are being used currently in Copilot PCs, Copilot Plus PCs. So I'm not really familiar with the Snapdragon processors in phones, but I know there are more available than the ones that are being used in Copilot Plus PCs. Tristan says, if you're up for the challenge, it could be fun to build your own PC. Then you get everything you want without major compromises. And depending on the budget, of course, is important too, because for those who are particular about the components, yes, you'll get the components you want. It typically will cost you a little bit more than just buying a pre-built PC that is generic, across the board, got, you know, just a, and more often than not, you will end up with a PC. If you buy one that's pre-built, it's basically all of the components are designed at the same sort of performance level. So you won't end up with a $10,000 video card in a $500 PC, for example. So, you know, they'll be more tuned to work together. Of course, if you are building your own, you probably are very particular about exactly what it is that you want. And if you want that, yeah, that's the only way to get it, is build your own, really.
Husband says that the best computer is my old computer. It works, I already have it, and it's free.
Exactly. Exactly.
If you do decide to build your own PC, look into it a lot. There are some sites, I think one is called PC Picker or something like that, because there are incompatibilities between different devices. There's PCIe 3 and 2 and 4. There's lanes to worry about. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I haven't worried about with my laptop. But if you're going to build a desktop PC, then there are a lot of compatibility problems that may occur. And so take a look around a lot before you start to spec it out.
Yeah. Okay, I think that we've covered everything. If I don't mind sticking around some more if I missed anything or if anybody else has anything, but I think we've gone through everything that's in the chat. There's a very long chat that we've got in the recording for today. So as a wrap-up, in case we don't get anything else, I'd like to thank everybody for coming out. I hope it was useful to people, and I think that I learned some things from input that other people had, and I already have a couple of slides that I think I'll do minor modifications to. Tom wants to put me to work. He thinks that I should give this every 2 years to get suggestions and comments from others. Probably a very good idea, but it is a lot of work. So I can't promise that, but I do modify this presentation on an ongoing basis because I do give it periodically at the Ottawa Public Library as well. They tend to be a little bit less discerning than the audience here. So thank you very much, folks. And if you have any questions, by all means, you know how to get in touch with me. And I hope to see more people out at Q&A every week, and we can certainly bring up issues like this at Q&A too if people need further clarification or they can expand on things. That would be welcome at Q&A as always. And so thanks very much. And with that, I think I will call it to a close.